Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Latin America Review by Calcetia News. And this week, we're going to be talking about Ecuador and President Guillermo Lasso's fall from grace. And we're going to talk about that with our good friend, Ecuadorian journalist Esteban Carrillo. How's it going, Esteban? I wanted to start this discussion on Ecuador today because a few months ago, we saw protests. And we saw a lot of media coverage. Since then, international media coverage has been pretty absent. But if you look at the poll numbers for the neoliberal president, Guillermo Lasso, I saw one poll the other day with he's standing at a 16% approval rating. When he came into office, he had something like a 65% approval rating. So what has happened? What explains this fall from grace within such a short period of time?
Hi, Oli, and hi to everyone listening in. Thank you for having me on. Well, that's a lot to unpack, actually. Since the protests, many things have happened. But overall, the drop in poll numbers are mainly related to his mismanagement, his complete lack of understanding of how a public official, the work of a public official. Guillermo Lasso is a banker. He was gifted his position in a bank from his family when he was very young, from his wife's family, I'm sorry. And the people who support him to this day, they will always maintain that he was a great manager of that bank and that they had hoped that that would translate to being a great president. And that's obviously not been the case because the situation in Ecuador currently is dire to say the least. This is, I know you lived there for a few years. You might remember how it was. It was a very lovely place to live, but it was a very, you could even say quiet. You could say, but now it's one of the most dangerous countries in all of Latin America. The homicide rate is completely through the roof. The levels of inequality, the levels of unemployment, the public investment, it's non-existent. So, as the lower third says, the neoliberal nightmare, that is exactly what we're living in. And even though Lasso, he won by the skin of his teeth last year, and he had a high approval rating once he actually took office, his complete misunderstanding of what it means to be a public official has just left those very few people to support him, very few who are obviously getting something from this government, more likely than not. And obviously, probably many who are just very misguided, who believe a lot of the lies that are spread by the mainstream media, by the owners of the television stations, of the newspapers, by the corporate media, who benefit from having a person who is interested in only keeping the foreign reserves full instead of building new schools or new hospitals or new roads.
Yeah, you're right. Just for those listening, for full disclosure, Esteban and I used to work together in Quito, and we worked at Telesilvia many, many happy times. And I wanted to mention that because when I was in Quito, which was sort of 2018, 2019, there was a sense that the situation on specifically around crime was starting to go out of control. And this was about 2 or 3 years into Lenin Moreno's government. Since then, the situation seems to have got a whole lot worse, both on the streets and in the prisons itself, where there's been a total lawlessness there. As someone who knows Ecuador from when Rafael Correa was president as well, do you think the causes of this sharp rise in crime and violence in Ecuador? And what were some of the differences between Correa's time and what people are living in? With now?
It would have to be mainly when Lenin Moreno came to power in 2017, one of the first things he did was undo a lot of the most of what the citizen revolution had built up to that point. And up to that point, the Correa administration, it had managed to bring down the homicide rate, to bring down how much drug was produced in Ecuador, how much it was being trafficked. Things were under control, if we want to say it that way. Once the powers changed, once the old oligarchy came back to power, the only thing they cared about was to acquiesce to anything that the U.S. embassy demanded, and to undo anything that had to any relation to the citizens' revolution. That included repealing the justice ministry, making it disappear, folding it into the interior ministry. The justice ministry used to be in charge of the prisons. And now the interior ministry, which was in charge of only of the police, now is in charge of everything. And then you put someone like Maria Paula Romo, who is a complete American stooge, I'm sorry to say it, but that's the only way I can think to describe her, in charge of the interior ministry. And what did she do? The only thing she did was criminalize the street protests, and nothing else. And like, give the police all of the ability to, they didn't have any oversight. They no longer had oversight. The police would be the ones investigating themselves. They would be the ones setting their own rules. While in the Correa administration, the police was overseen by civilians. So they removed, they defunded the prisons, they defunded the police, they defunded everything you can imagine. So of course, last year, we started to see the prison massacres. That's when Ecuador came back on the news. It used to be that we had the best roads in Latin America. It used to be that we were one of the safest countries in South America. Now we have over 400 deaths inside the prisons, and these are very violent deaths. These are massacres in the entire meaning of
that. Just to be clear, people getting slaughtered. These prison massacres are not necessarily by the authorities. They're among prisoners themselves who are allowed to bring in even high caliber weapons into the prisons, right?
Exactly. These people are better armed than the police. They are the police. Recently, there was a coroner who gave an interview who was saying that in Esmeraldas, which is a province in the north of Ecuador, it has a border with Colombia, it's mainly Afro-Ecuadorian. The police hasn't been able to enter the prison for 9 months. For 9 months, the police has not been able to enter the prison because the gangs inside are so well armed that the police just cannot. They need to come in by the thousands. So that's what happened. This is where it actually started, the insecurity problem. It's the moment the government lost control of the prisons, they lost control of everything. And it's also because we've had a very, very damaging and very thorough influx of the Mexican drug cartels. Right now in Ecuador, you're not talking about local gangs anymore. You're talking about the Sinaloa cartel. You're talking about the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel. These are the people who are actually behind the drug trade in Ecuador right now. They are in control of it. They are the ones battling it. Last month, I believe the BBC even did a, I don't remember if it was exactly the BBC, it was a European outlet. They did an expose that spoke about Albanian gangs being in control of the drug routes out of Ecuador into Europe. So the situation devolved. It devolved in the span of maybe 2 years, because while the Moreno government was absolutely nothing to, there's really very little you can say good about it, the situation under Lasso has just devolved at a rate that I think a lot of people, even in Ecuador, are just starting to realize how bad it is. What these gangs are doing, it's completely out of control. That's even putting it mildly, the situation on the streets. I am currently not living in Ecuador, but my family, every single day I talk to them, and every single day it's bad news. There's not a day that I have spoken back to Ecuador in which I hear anything good. It's a complete state abandonment. That's what is happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just anecdotally, I remember I have a friend in the coast of Ecuador, Puerto Lopez it's called. And we used to go there a lot, weekends, sitting on the beach till the early hours of the morning and, not caring the world. But now there's a whole phenomenon of armed robberies on the beach where tourists sit on the beach, people come on motorbikes, big guns. and it's just rigged the whole thing. And that has massively affected the tourist economy as well, obviously, because people no longer want to go. If tourists are there, they're not spending as much money at the bars, the restaurants, on the beach, because there's this insecurity, and there seems to be a total lack of control compared to even just a couple of years ago. But in the face of this sort of crisis, which is, you know, also an economic crisis, obviously Rafael Correa himself is not in Ecuador, and he's not going to be able to come back before, at the earliest before the next elections in the next few years in Ecuador. He is exiled, persecuted by the government. So what are the sort of formations on the left that could challenge this government? What parties are there? What is the possibility of a reconcilement between some of that left represented by Correa and perhaps the indigenous movement that led the mobilizations a few months ago and in 2019? You know, what are the prospects for the left going forward?
I think it's difficult to say at the moment, in particular to that, because the left in Ecuador was very damaged by the persecution of the leaders. It started with Correa and the Citizens' Revolution. It was always a movement that was built around Correa. There's really never really any candidates built from the Citizens' Revolution that were in him. And when they did one, we saw what happened with Lenin Moreno, the media treason. Now, there's been some maybe very slight rapprochement, very slight communications between Rafael Correa and Leonidas Issa, who's the current president of the Indigenous Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities, Leonidas Issa, who led the protest, who has been kind of at the forefront of opposing Lasso's policies. But there is also the question of Issa being very beholden to the CONAIE, to the Confederation, and to Pachakutik, which is the political arm. And if he ever decides to back Correa or to form an alliance with Correa, that would mean stepping away from the indigenous movement, because at least as the situation stands right now, it's very difficult to see the whole of the indigenous movement to move towards Correa, because of how much he's been demonized, how much the actual the failures of his government, in particular in relation to the indigenous movement, who are still hold many grudges, but mainly it has to do with the lawfare, with the persecution, as we've seen in many other Latin American countries. I think in Ecuador we're seeing the most damage caused by that. The tales that are usually spread in the media, the idea that Rafael Correa stole $70 billion. Last year, Ecuador's GDP was just over $100 billion. So imagine, you know, Correa stole $70 billion. He'll be among the top five richest people in the world. And this is what people will repeat in Ecuador. This is what people believe. This is as if it's the gospel. But it's misinformation. It's information warfare. So it's a very difficult, I would say, it's an uphill battle. Last year we had a very good candidate from the left in Andrés Arauz, and from the moment he was announced to be a candidate of the left, Andrés was being persecuted. He was being they tried to stop him from running. They tried they handed Correa the sentence, his sentence for a psychic influence. Committing corruption via psychic influence the day before he was supposed to be officially announced as Andrés Arauz's running mate for that election. So and then throughout the whole election process, it was just persecution, it was just lies, it was just the dirtiest campaign you can imagine. And sadly, a lot of people believe it, a lot of people buy into it, because in Latin America, and I'm guessing it's similar throughout the world, there's this idea that if the TV tells you something, it must be true. So I think that's where the battle actually lies. I think any political force, there could be rapprochement, there could be alliances, but they're going against culture of anti-socialism, a culture of anti-progressives. And we're seeing a new stage of that. And I feel like Ecuador is becoming kind of like the proving ground for this this new era in persecution, this new era in lawfare. And next year we have the sectional elections. It's for mayors, for governorships. And the last time I read it, there were going to be over 60,000 candidates running. So that's just, it goes to show you how broken our current electoral system is and how broken the political system is in Ecuador. So while there is always hope, I feel like from the point we're in right now, it's still a very, very difficult uphill battle.
Absolutely. And to close out this section, I want to just ask more in a more general sense. We see a lot of stories in terms of the statistics in Ecuador about young people leaving the country, immigrating out. I mean, you are one of them. You are Ecuadorian. You lived and worked in Ecuador, and now you no longer do. Is there a future for young people in Ecuador going forward? And do you think we're likely to see sharp rise in, emigration, migration out of Ecuador as opportunities just disappear?
Well, I've had to emigrate twice in my life from Ecuador, exactly for the same reason, the two times, because of a neoliberal government that decided that the only policies they care about was their own pockets and everyone else could be fed to the wolves. Today, I'm currently living in Lebanon, thankfully for due to a job offer. I got here and I've been here for the past year. As far as the future in Ecuador, that is, I don't think so. At the moment, with the situation as it is, kids with very high scores are not being able to go into university, even though this was one of Lasso's campaign promises, that anyone could go into school. Well, they can't. These people, these kids with the highest scores, because they don't have the connections, because they don't have the money to pay under the table, they simply cannot go to school. And that's one of the reasons too why we're seeing the situation with the gangs, the complete law of the Wild West currently, because the kids can't go to school, the kids can't go to learn a job, they can't even go out on the street without hearing a gun battle. They are being recruited in their own neighborhoods to become killers, to become assassins. It's just young kids of like 13, 12 years old. There's absolute abandonment. Every month of this year, there's been 3,000 Ecuadorians detained at the US border. And there's been, like, since 2020, there's been 5,000 Ecuadorian children abandoned at the US border. This brings to mind the situation of Central America a few years ago, when the migrant caravans were set out of Honduras, from El Salvador. From Guatemala, from people who were so desperate for any opportunity, for any chance to have a better life. That doesn't even mean a good life. It just means a better life than from having to run away from the assassins, having to run away from the people who blackmail. Right now, one of the biggest things in Ecuador is blackmail. It's shop owners, it's anyone with a business, even anyone with a business is getting a blackmail to pay for protection by these gangs. And it's not even just the businesses, it's in the schools. In the schools, they're asking the parents to pay a daily fee so that their kids don't get shot. So it's it really brings to mind the worst that we have ever seen in our continent. Ecuador, at one point, we were closer to the South American dream. We were closer to what the Gueros believed Chile was. We were closer to that. And now it feels like we're just going down the well where there's very little differentiating us from Haiti. There's very little differentiating us from El Salvador.
And so welcome back to part two of Latin America Review. this. So Esteban, in this section, what we do with our guests each week is we want to learn a bit about the culture of the country of our interviewees, and do so through food, music, and then the run-up to the World Cup through football as well. So what we do is I propose an imaginary dinner party, and then you'll rate me out of 10 at the end. So for our starters of this Ecuadorian dinner party, we're going to have mini bolones. Would you care to explain what a bolón is in Ecuador? What goes into it? What's your favorite type?
Oh, the bolón, it's from Esmeraldas. It's green plantain. It's mashed up green plantain made into a ball. You know, you're saying a mini bolón. The bolóns are usually like this, and they're full of cheese. They're full of the pork rinds. They're the most delicious thing, with a lot of ají, with a lot of hot sauce. I would say that's my favorite. I would say the cheese one is my favorite, actually. Just, you know, when you split one open and the melted cheese comes out. Oh, for anybody who hasn't had a green plantain, I feel for you.
Yeah, so I mean, Ecuador is the world capital of green plantain, right?
Yes. We're the champions.
Absolutely. And so for the main course, this is an Andean comfort food, which I always had when I was in Quito at the weekends, hornado. Right? Can you tell us what is hornado? What areas of Ecuador does that come from?
Hornado, it's the pork. It's the roasted pork, usually the roasted whole. And it comes with the little potato patties that are called yapingachos, and a little salad, the agrio, which is a sauce made with beer and a lot of onion, a lot of tomato. It's the most delicious thing. That one is my favorite Ecuadorian dish, hornado. And it comes from different places. There's different types of hornados in Ecuador. There's the hornado pastuso, which is from the north, from Ibarra. This one's a little drier. I'm not that big a fan of. There's the hornado in Riobamba, which is in the south, in the province of Chimborazo. That was probably the one I prefer the most, because it is not very dry. It's very juicy, and again, with a delicious plate of ají, best meal.
Brilliant. As obviously we have to have a drink on the table, and one of my favorite Ecuadorian drinks, we'd have a bottle of caña manabita, which is it's the same as aguardiente in Colombia. It's made from sugarcane. Is that something you miss there in Lebanon? Because I remember it would sometimes split opinions, particularly among some of the foreigners that we worked with, weren't too keen on it. I'd sometimes be the only person turning up with it. So, you know, is that something that you miss there now that you're outside of Ecuador?
I miss it because it's Ecuadorian. I was also not the biggest fan of caña manabita or aguardiente, just because it's very strong. And I remember you liking the strong drinks. But it is the sugar cane. It is manabita. It's from the province of Manabí. This is a very, very popular drink, very very common, you know, like you can find it anywhere. It's very cheap. And it can be from some very good cocktails. But at least here in Lebanon, I found something called arak that I actually find even more delicious. And maybe we can talk about it some other time.
Treasonous. Obviously, we've got to have some music going on in the background as well. And when we had Andres Arauz on this show, we had Julio Jaramillo. We talked about his great history in Ecuador, his many children that he had in different regions of the whole world, really. But so today I wanted to change up a little bit different. So since we're having hornado for the main, which is an Andean dish, wanted to have the Andean music, specifically the sorts of music you hear in Otavalo. And one specific song, which I absolutely love, called Whiskycito by the Joquiwas. What do you reckon? Is it, I mean, Otavalo music of Otavalo, which you get across the Andes, you know, like in Quito, I remember there wasn't a lot of opportunities to listen to that music, but is it something you think can build some momentum and get a new share in Ecuador?
I think so for sure. I know that in Peru, in Bolivia, this music is very big, and we have the same heritage. We have the same, our mountains sound the same. And I do think so. I think what you've chosen for our background music, for a soundtrack of this meal is perfect, is perfection. I wish I could be there right now, listening to this and eating that delicious hornado.
Definitely. Yeah, man, I mean, it's a shame because in Bolivia, at least, you hear folkloric music kind of everywhere, but in Quito, it's a lot less. Although in the carnival of Riobamba, they had Los Carcas playing there, which is the biggest folkloric band of Bolivia. Mm-hmm. People were going absolutely crazy for that, and it was mostly young people as well. So it shows that there's definitely a market for that. So anyway, what would you give that as a score out of 10? Seven. You got Bolognese for start, Hornado for main, got a bottle of Caña Manabita on the table. We've got, Andean music from Otavalo playing in the background. What is your score out of 10?
I would give it a nine. And the only reason I'm not giving it a 10 is because I would personally prefer a Pilsener on the table. Ah, a very cold Pilsener from Ecuador.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
So nine. That's a respectable score. Probably one of my highest scores I've got. My lowest was El Salvador, where they gave me a 6. So that was a disappointing score for me. But rank first there. And then before we close up for good, you know, obviously we've got the World Cup coming up, and we're going to be launching a new project around that. So keep your eyes peeled for that, for all the listeners. But Ecuador is one of the 4 South American countries going to this World Cup. There was some questions about whether they'd actually be able to make it, around Chile trying to snake them after it turned out that one of Ecuador's players may have been Colombian. But what do you reckon, how, you know, as an Ecuadorian, how excited are you to see, you know, your country in this World Cup? Do you think they'll actually be able to, for example, get out of their group stages? Ecuador's actually the first match is going to be played, right?
You have no idea how proud I am that Ecuador is playing the first match. I've been scouring the streets of Beirut looking for an Ecuadorian jersey and a flag, because I need it for that first match. And I just need them to beat Qatar. If they beat Qatar, I'll be the happiest person on the planet. And I get to see it right here at the same time. So.
Oh yeah, of course. In your part of the world now. Are there any particular players that people should be looking out for? Any of the, you know, the stars going into this, for the non-Ecuadorian who may not know necessarily the whole team?
Well, I would say look out for Milo Castillo, because he's the one that Chile tried to use to kick us out, and he like vampire on them. So let's cheer him on.
Absolutely. I mean, in the Premier League now, there's a lot of Ecuadorian players at Brighton, you know, people like Moises Caicedo, Elvis Estupiñán, all in the same team. Do you think that's been a good place for them to sort of get up to speed ahead of the World Cup?
I would hope so. And just to like drop a little political commentary into that, a lot of our players were able to develop thanks to the sports programs of the Citizens Revolution. Our team is very well built, and we have a lot to thank to what happened during those 10 years in which Ecuador was going up instead of going down.